We're here with Ryan Jurdusky, and Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Hello.
How to be Tom Shalhoub. Starring Tom Shalhoub. You know, not everybody wants to be Tom Shalhoub. But for those people who do, I guess this podcast is for them. I mean, you got to model yourself after someone, right? Might as well be me, Tom Shalhoub.
Okay, I want to talk about a couple of things. First, let's start with the 1776 project because, you know, it was maybe last week, maybe a couple of days ago, I saw Randy Weingarten tweet out, a congratulatory tweet to all her sisters in the education establishment. She said that 1776 Project and Moms for Liberty failed. They lost 80% of the races that they were involved in. And you immediately said, Randy, that's not the way it happened. So what were her numbers? Where'd she get them? What are the real numbers?
I have no idea where she got them because they didn't make any sense whatsoever. We won. So there was 114 competitions. We won races. We won 100. We won 69 of them. So we won about 60%. It's like 59.7, 60.1, something like that. But we won about 60% of all the races that we competed in. I don't know where she got the 80% loss from. And then she revised from 80 to 70, which still didn't make any sense.
Oh, so she did respond. She responded to your tweet with new numbers?
Well, what happened was the Associated Press changed her quote. So I'm assuming that she just changed it. I don't really understand. She never directly has ever engaged with me. But they did change it from 80 to 70, which is still not correct. Maybe Moms for Liberty I know that they won less races than we did, but I don't know where they got that number from. It has nothing to do with our win record ever. We won 60% of all the races that we took part in, 69 of them, and including in some very blue areas. And so we were happy with our record. I don't know where she made that up from.
Yeah. Okay. So some people who are listening, they might not know what 1776 Project is. So let's kind of start with that. It's a PAC, right?
It's a PAC. It's a political action committee, the only political action committee dedicated nationwide to electing conservatives for school board. I started in 2021. We've since campaigned for 200 people who have won their school board seat who are on sitting school boards since 2021. So this year we won over 100. We've increased our numbers every single year. Our first year we won, I think, 42. Our second year we won about 70. And then our third year we won over 100. So we're slowly increasing the size of our organization, what we do, how many races we do it in. And we have some big things I think we're going to expand into next year. So I'm very excited about that.
I guess the question would be a lot of people looking at these races because they see the school boards, they see what they're trying to do. Because we have parents showing up reading, the basic, like the pornography that's in the libraries and things like that. So you would almost expect it to be, you look at those numbers, you say, yeah, 60%, that's great. Why is anybody voting for these lunatics on the school boards?
Well, I think that, what we did some polling earlier this year, and honestly, the left did a very good job of fighting over the idea of book banning. We really didn't talk about it in any races at all, the idea of pushing out books at the libraries, because what happened was, I don't really know where the narrative got taken over, but the narrative got taken over that we were pushing, that they were going to push out books like Maya Angelou or other books, and for some reason, the conversation to the left had done things like Ban to Kill a Mockingbird, which they did in a couple places, or Of Mice and Men in a great American literature, didn't resonate. So what we looked at was, where are voters concerned right now? And yeah, there are a lot of conservatives who are very concerned over the idea of pornography in schools, and I am too. And what I always say is, if a book is a graphic novel, and if they made the picture version of the graphic novel, if there's a graphic novel And the graphics are so explicit, they could not be made in picture form, which is the truth of many of these children's books. You cannot they've made graphic novels of children being sodomized, children being engaged in sexual manners that could not be translated into photographs. Otherwise, the author would go to jail for those kinds of books because literally child pornography. That's one conversation we like to have. But and when we polled parents, we sat there and said, what are the biggest issues? Bullying, the fear of school shootings, the fear of kids being beat up in school by other students was polled at number one. We just had a story, I think, yesterday of that 17-year-old who was killed in his school in Las Vegas by 15 fellow teenagers who beat him up, and they beat him to death. There are stories of violence in schools across the country. So school safety was actually our number one issue targeted for. Our second thing was talking a lot about merit. Critical race theory, people don't know how it can creep up. They want one of the most explicit, explosive things as a way to make a big story out of it. But it has many pervasive ways of showing up in a school district in praxis. One of which way is the watering down of merit and the watering down of punishment standards. In some school districts, you have where the school trying to make an equitable environment makes an equal level of suspensions and detentions and expulsions for kids of every race. So obviously not every race is equal in everything. So they over-suspend some groups and under-suspend other groups, or over-detention one group and under-detention the other group. And they water down merit. Thomas Jefferson High School in Virginia was the number one high school in America for decades, and they got rid of testing as a way to improve equity, and I don't think it's even in the top 50 anymore. So, that happened in the blink of an eye. So we spoke to voters in a way that said, listen, if we know that these culture wars are happening in school, if they weren't, if we had no culture war fights in school, were public schools still succeeding in this country? Because they're not. You know when it's bad when a school district is considered a good district if only one in three kids is failing or not proficient in reading and math. That's a good school is only one in three are failing. Yeah. That's an unacceptable standard.
So this, the Thomas Jefferson High School that you referenced, what are the parents like in that district? They must be upset that their school was once great and now it's no longer great. What do the parents of black kids with A's and B's think of their school getting the quality reduced in such a way?
Well, the alumni rather of that school district were very, very deeply upset. What I've noticed and what we've seen is the group of parents that are the most active in pushing back on it are a lot of Asian immigrant parents, because they don't have this immense level of repressed thinking that we just have to water down everything so that way we can make up for the history of slavery. Like they don't believe in that value whatsoever. Nor do a lot of Asian immigrants have the same belief, which is a false concept, that poverty means you do bad in school. I'll tell you two really quick things. One, in Queens County, the county that I was born and raised in and live in, the poorest economic group ethnically are Asians. They make the least amount of money and they go to the most advanced schools. They have the highest placement, the highest grades, and the least violence. Poverty has nothing to do with achievement whatsoever. And then in the state of Mississippi passed a great law 5 years ago that says if you cannot read at a third grade level, you cannot move to fourth grade, because a lot of school districts, to keep high graduation rates, fail kids forward. They just say, no, just keep passing and passing and passing. And by the time they reach eighth grade in high school, they can't read or write at a eighth grade level. So what Mississippi did was, we cannot go to a fourth grade if you can read a third grade level. They hired a great superintendent who made sure that happened. They put money back in phonics and in early childhood intervention. And they, in 5 years, they went from number 49 in reading to number 29. Nationwide. And this is not a rich state. This is not an all white state. This is not a state that's supposed to have certain levels of privilege. This is a state with half the population is black, majority are poor. And now, because they actually enforce reading and curriculum and standards, a majority can read in the third grade, which is the first time that's happened, who knows, probably ever. That's a huge groundbreaking thing. And that's a conservative win. So we've addressed the culture war issues where they exist. But Randy Weingartner is not just failing kids because she believes everyone should be trans and have CRT and feel guilty for being white and all the rest of it. She's failing on the bare bones academics that a majority of kids are leaving school without the proficiency of reading and doing math. And they will not have, and being a good citizen, by the way, not learning civics, but they will not have the bare essentials to be a successful adult in many of these cases.
Yeah. Now, the 1776 Project, tell me if I was confused, if it was the same thing. Like during the Trump administration, everyone was hearing about the 1619 Project. And then I remember, you know, most of my news, it's because I'm around Fox News all the time. So I see news stories come in for about 3 or 4 days, and then I don't hear about them again. But there was a 1776 Project that the Trump administration made use of and got some headlines out of. And it was essentially, it was an anti-CRT kind of program called 1776. Was that your project?
No, I made mine as like a tongue-in-cheek of the 1619 Project. And Trump's 1776 Project had already ended when mine began because Biden got rid of it the first day of his administration.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you said your 1776 was the only pact that's devoted to getting people elected to school boards. People kind of lump you in with Moms of Liberty, like Randy Weingarten did. But what is Moms for Liberty? They do something a little different?
Yeah, so Moms for Liberty does school board elections too, but they run chapter organizations. We don't run chapter organizations. So what we do as an organization is we find candidates that are going to run. We endorse them, and then we put money behind their race. We send out mailers to voters because in, I think, 43 states, all school board elections are nonpartisan. And then actually, I think it's a little higher. That might be 44, but 44 states are nonpartisan. So people don't really know. There's no R or D behind someone's name. A lot of people go to the ballot not knowing who they are. So we identify the Republican voters, conservative candidates. We highlight information as far as which districts people are running in, as far as what stories are happening there, what are the systemic issues, what are the reading and math scores like. And then we are starting to run Get Out the Vote efforts on behalf of the candidates. Moms for Liberty has different grassroots organizations, but they are not a PAC. They may have a PAC component, but they don't do what we do.
Yeah. And so do you have to run around and, you know, how do you get money?
Small dollar donors. That's a great question. You know, we were lucky enough. We had like one very large dollar donor. But besides that, we run solely on small dollar donors. I think last quarter we raised $625,000 from 25,000 people who gave an average like $27.
Yeah.
That's literally how we run the money. And that's how we are like a squirrel. We save our winter nut. We raise the money now to spend in the spring and then raise in the summer to spend in the fall. And that's basically how we've been operating, how we do it. We're super successful right now. I think last quarter we were number 30 of all Republican PACs or conservative PACs nationwide. We were ahead of several presidential races.
For your record that you have?
No, for how much money we raised.
Oh, really? Okay. You raised, give me the numbers again. You raised how much?
So we raised last quarter, I think it was like $627,000 from small dollar donors.
Yeah.
Solely small dollar donors. We were beating, Asa Hutchinson, which is a presidential candidate, but not Cornel West. So like we were raising, but that's a lot of money from small donors. We really don't have many large dollar donors giving us, you know, once in a while, someone will come through with a very big check and I'm always appreciative, but our lifeline, our lifeblood that keeps us going are those $25 checks. Yeah. Every month from people. That's what really does this entire operation. And we're super happy because we keep them informed of what their money is going to. So we contact school board members after they win and we just say, hey, what are you doing? What's going on? What are you doing now that you are in this position, you're in this place, and how is education improving? And I'm hopeful that in 2 more years, we can go to our first crop of elected candidates and look at their math and reading scores and hope they've gone up and hope we have better civic engagement and civic education. And we could say, hey, look, this was a long-term investment, but it actually worked.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't sound like that much money when we're talking about politics, but I guess it's because these are smaller races. These people don't need the kind of millions that governors and people running for president need, right?
We do like 30,000, 40,000 per district. I mean, it depends. Some states are countywide, like Nevada, California, Florida are countywide. They're expensive races. We did Florida last year. But if you're talking about like Texas, New York, other places, they're smaller, but they do matter. I mean, you sit there and say, what does this matter if I flipped? And we flipped the sixth largest school district in Ohio last Tuesday. What does it matter? Well, it's 27,000 students. So you spend $30,000, you're doing basically a little more than a dollar per student, but 31,000 students have a conservative school board that are gonna work to sit there and route out a lot of the bad social stuff, a lot of trying to get merit up and get standards up and make sure that they're protected in their school buildings, which is, I mean, the most you could ask for.
And what are you buying with that 30,000? Like, there was just a county election where I'm from, and I'm in Bronxville, Yonkers area. And
great area.
Westchester had a huge county legislator election, and this guy James Nolan, he's the big conservative, who's running around there, but it's all lawn signs and knocking on doors. That's what I get. I mean, that's James Nolan. You see his name on lawn signs, and I had a lot of people knocking on my door. Is that the way you guys do it?
No, well, we don't do any lawn signs. I don't believe lawn signs are actually worth it. My own special several like 18 years of working on campaigns, I think lawn signs are mostly a waste of money. What we do, but candidates love seeing their names on them, so whatever. What we do is we do one mailers. So we go to soft for Republicans, people who don't always vote, and we one show them what's going on in their school district, and here's a conservative. Identifying the names of the people to Republican voters is the first step, because they're nonpartisan. So often people vote for elections, they don't know who they are. Then the second step that we do is we do a get out the vote effort, usually through text messaging or direct phone calling. We run a digital operation where basically we will take local news stories and we will put them on, like, when people are browsing, they'll see a story from their local district and says, make sure you vote for school board, and it'll show you where you're supposed to vote. We run that through the C4 operation because it's not like super partisan. And then that's how our main thing is. So we do direct mail, text messaging, digital, and live calls. Next year, what I've grown to understand is where the county parties are strong and where the county Republican parties, and there's a top of the person, a top of the ballot effort to really drive out Republican voters, we have been more successful, obviously, because when everyone works in cohesion, everything's better. What we're looking at, because school boards for like New York and Missouri and Texas and Florida are in the spring of next year, not in the fall. So a lot of people will not be voting because they're being off elections. What I'm thinking about doing is diverting more energy to get Republicans out early, to do our own, as a pack, our own get out the vote early drive to drive out Republican voters who are lower propensity. And that's what happened in Virginia. And that's why Republicans, although they lost the state house, they gained a seat in the state Senate, and the losses weren't as severe as people. They won everything Biden plus 8 and below. So I think we could do that and match that effort.
What do you think happened? The story around here, all the panels were the next day, oh my gosh, Republicans again, they lost. Was it as sad of a story as it sounded? I mean, you talked about Virginia, Ohio. What happened last week, or whenever this thing happened? Was it that bad for Republicans?
Well, look at Virginia. Virginia Republicans did almost as well as they did in 2021. They won every place that Biden had won by at most 8 points. That is not easy. They should have lost a lot more seats. It's that the threshold for the tipping point seat for Republicans was like Biden plus 11, and they couldn't sink that. But Virginia is a D plus 10 state. Think of it like this. Democrats are one seat advantage in the state house and one seat advantage of the state Senate in a D plus 10 state. Arizona is an even keel state, middle of the road, and Republicans only have a one House seat majority and a one state Senate seat majority. If the entire country had done as well as Virginia Republicans that day, we would have over 350 House seats in the United over 250 House seats in the United States House of Representatives. They did enormously well given the odds of being in a Democrat state, which is what Virginia is now. The big thing that has been happening for the last 10 years, and we're seeing it more and more and more, As white college-educated voters are becoming more democratic in their views and in their belief systems and how they act, and we are losing high propensity voters. No one votes as often as a college-educated white American. And we've traded them in for lower propensity Hispanics, lower propensity whites. They are not voting as frequently, and they are not voting in high enough numbers. To get through that threshold, apparently, unless Donald Trump is on the ballot, so that's that one caveat. But so to make up for that, we are going to have to run our own operation to engage with non-college educated whites, non-frequent voting Asian and Hispanic voters, and get them to the polls, drive them to the polls ourselves, because they are not going to just vote on their own. And that's how we're going to make up for losing college educated whites.
Will we ever get the college educated whites to, you know, where'd they go? Why are they all there? I mean, in the last election, we heard it was suburban moms. They just didn't like Trump. The mom, you know, and I think it's true. The moms I know, the suburban moms I know, they don't want to even look at that guy anymore. They're like, I don't want Trump anymore. I mean, these are like Republican moms.
But, yeah.
So I believe that the suburban moms thing was right. And they just don't like whatever it is about Trump, the rudeness, they don't like him. So I believe that, but what's with the, are you saying across the board, college educated whites, they're.
Yeah. Is whites, because they're more socially progressive than the average person. And they are more economically secure than the average person. And they are in safer communities than the average person. So Republican messages that kept those groups Republican for years don't really translate anymore. They're more economically prosperous. They don't have to worry about taxes slightly going up or the cost of living. They don't have to worry about crime going up that much, and they don't have to worry about, and they're socially progressive overall. Even though they have higher church attendance rates than non-college educated whites, they are still more socially progressive. And it matters a lot to a lot of people about being socially condemned. You don't want to be the only Trump person at a party. It's not a comfortable feeling. So as there's a lot of pressure among each other to become progressive, I think that's also fed into it part of the way. And that's definitely hurt us. Will we ever get them back? I don't know. That's the million-dollar question. And if I did that, I'd be winning a lot of money on betting odds for the future presidential race. They certainly voted for some Republicans like Brian Kemp, like the governor, like Ron DeSantis, like the governor of Ohio, like the governor of Iowa. They are certainly voted Republican where it mattered. But for the governor's races, will they come back for the U.S. Senate races, for the presidential races? It really just depends on what the priorities are. What are we talking about? And how does the president present himself? I think that's a big, big, big question. There's room for to speak to them. You just have to know the messaging, and it has to be the correct way.
Okay, so getting to that, like when we're talking national politics now, we're talking about Trump. I thought it was interesting because I went on to your Substack. What is it, NatPop?
Yeah, National Populist Substack. Thank you.
Yeah, so I've been saying for a year to everybody around here, I go on these panel shows with, people here at Fox News, Gutfeld show, the guests, whatever. And then anybody I talk to in my daily life, and they're all like, oh, Trump's coming back and, whatever. And I say to them, Trump is about to lose again, and he's going to lose big. That's all I say to people. That's what I've thought for the past year. Although the past few weeks, I'm wondering if I'm right about that. Like, I tell people this and they really don't like what I'm saying, but I think Democrats, they know how to beat Trump. They want to run against him again. They're propping him up. I think that they helped. They've been helping Trump for the past year because they're not afraid of him. They know how to beat him. They are confident that they're going to win Pennsylvania, that they're going to win Wisconsin, that they're going to win Arizona. Now, this is what I thought for the past year. But the past month, I'm like, am I wrong about this? And then you kind of said the same thing on your blog.
Yeah, I thought the same exact thing. I think that there are certain things that are happening that are changing the narrative. One, I think Americans have a value in the idea of fairness. Now, whether that is a bad idea or a good idea, if you say something is unfair, people have a very, they rally towards towards that. For whatever reason it is, they do. A lot of people do believe that the prosecutions are unfair. Even if they hate Trump, even if they think that he should go to jail, they do think that there is a fairness component. I think that that might be feeding into it one way. Joe Biden is really old, and he seems even older than he is. Although Trump is getting up there, he is really, really, really freaking old. The economy is way worse than I ever thought it would get. I mean, I don't know if you've gone to Costco lately, but the price of paper goods is got to be double from what it was 2 years ago. And you have a bad economy, an open border, and chaos around the globe. And kind of everything that Biden sold people really hurt. And there's a one last factor, which is when a president is no longer in office, they are always more popular than they were in office. Uh-huh. Jimmy Carter is beloved as a great leader. Bill Clinton is an honest guy. George W. Bush was dancing with Ellen DeGeneres, the lesbian woman who he wouldn't want her to get married. Everyone's forgiven in the hindsight of the rearview window. So now, 2 years, 3 years since Trump's presidency, oh, you know what? Maybe the tweets weren't that bad. Maybe things weren't as awful. I had a good year that year. Whatever the case is, everything is easily forgotten in hindsight. And I think that's what we're partially seeing.
Yeah, it's interesting because you believe the numbers with the blacks and Hispanics?
The black vote, I think, is a complete lie. The Hispanic vote is, the black vote is a complete. But remember, when you look at a poll, right, the overall sample size may be 1,300 people. The black vote may be 128 people. And of the 128, they may be finding 30 saying they're going to vote for Trump. Because when you get down to the smaller and smaller and smaller sample sizes, there's a larger chance that those small sample sizes are wrong by a larger margin. And if you read, like, I know the CNN poll, I believe the Fox poll, they say, okay, the overall margin of error is 3 points, but the margin of error for, like, the white vote is 4 points, and black vote is 7 points, and Hispanic vote is 11 points because there's fewer people. That's why you do the overall thing. I think there's a real movement among Hispanics. I think there might be some traction with young black men, but I think for black voters over the age of 45, you're not going to see a change whatsoever. I think you're not going to see anything until there's a generational change.
Yeah. Do you think Trump is, because the other thing about Trump is, I'm just looking at him and I'm not seeing him, you know, like his only job now is to make 52% of the country like him, right? That's all he has to do. He doesn't seem, I mean, he doesn't seem to have any interest in that at all. Like, he seems perfectly happy that 40% of the country loves him and he wants them to love him even more. But I don't even see him doing anything that approaches trying to make people that he needs to vote for him like him.
I don't see him anywhere. I remember being on Fox in 2015 and he would tweet something and it was breaking news. I'm not on Truth Social. Sorry, my dog is whining because he's not next to me. He's not on television very often. He's not tweeting. No one's on Truth Social. Not a single person on the planet is on Truth Social. You don't hear from him. The average person doesn't hear from him. And I think that absence is, to a certain degree, making the heart grow fonder, where he doesn't seem as annoying because the average person is not seeing him constantly. And I think that's to his benefit. I think if on election day 2016 he deleted his Twitter account, he would have won in 2020, because I think a lot of the stuff would have been less amplified, which is what's happening right now.
It's going to be interesting anyway, you know, however it goes down. But you think, I mean, it looks like he is, because, you know, even back in January, I was telling people on my local side, I said, I don't think Trump is going to be able to beat DeSantis. Because it just seemed to me painfully obvious. Like, I understand people like Trump. I mean, I like him. I kind of think he's fun and everything. And I think it would be hilarious if Trump were elected again. But it just seemed to me that Republicans would say, like, well, no, of course, you know, we can pick somebody here that can definitely win. You know, someone like DeSantis could. To me, it seems like he could easily win the presidential election. But it just didn't happen that way. You know, it looks like everybody still wants to go with Trump. you can't, you know, I don't want to lose sleep over it. You can't just get frustrated and say like, oh, why can't you see it? You know, it's so right in front of your face. People like who they like, and they seem to like Trump. But I mean, do you see him, he's still going out there and doing his rallies. I don't think those rallies do any good.
He's not doing that many rallies though. It's been few and fewer and fewer. I think the thing with one of the Republican voters is people forget, everyone forgot the midterms by March or April. Yeah. DeSantis was way too late getting into the race. Because in January, he was absolutely in number one position. And it dwindled as time went on and people forgot, oh, he just got 60% in Florida. That meant less and less and less because people's memories are the size of a gnat. And then lastly, and this is really what matters, DeSantis did not have a national message. Making America Florida is not a national message. You cannot plant palm trees in Florida. And too much of the campaign was reminiscent of either George W. Bush's 2000 race or Ted Cruz's 2016 primary. So heavily evangelical, so heavily, social conservative, to the point that it was very out of touch for 2023 Americans. And when I was with him, when I got to meet the governor, I'm so sorry about my dog. When I got to meet the governor, I said something to the effect of, you know, the Supreme Court case at Harvard is going to matter immensely. It's the number one biggest issue because it's going to affect private industry. It's going to affect a million things. There is a feeling, and this is not politically correct to say, but this is the truth. There is a feeling among white Americans that their children, especially their sons, are going to be discriminated against when it comes to hiring and college applications. Now, they're not alone. Asians feel that way too. Jews certainly feel that way, American Jews. But among American middle-class whites, there is a very quiet feeling, even among wealthier ones, that my kid is going to be not applicable because of his race. That's why they always say, put your Native American, your 100th Native American, put it down just to get in. And I said to DeSantis, for as smart as you are and for as good of a baseball player as you were in your prime, you might not have gotten into Yale today because you're a white man. And you need to convey that true frustration and anger of millions of people who are afraid to say it but feel it, because that is what Donald Trump did. And the media will hate you for it, and you could be, you know, you'll be the next great Satan, just like Trump will. But speaking the truth to power on those kinds of feelings is what matters, as well as a national vision of, I'm going to help the lives of the working class in these states by doing X, Y, and Z. He took a lot of time finding his footing, and I think that it hurt him.
Yeah, I think so. I want to let you go, walk your dog. I'm sure he wants to go out. But it occurred to me, you're a Catholic, right?
Yeah.
What do you think about what Francis is doing? I mean, I don't badmouth Francis because we're not supposed to, because he's the Pope, so you're not supposed to say bad things. I mean, I say that I don't like, certain things. You don't have to say, oh, I love everything the Pope does, but essentially, I don't like what he's doing. You know, this thing with the Bishop Strickland. I don't know if you're following this.
Yeah,
but he's right. I mean, he's firing bishops now. I don't know. Any thoughts on what's going on?
Francis was the worst possible replacement for Benedict, and I think there's a real conflict. And also, the cracking down the Latin Mass community is just horrific. A lot of things the Pope really can't change, because it is the eternal faith. It is the eternal Church. It is the one that not even the Pope can really alter that significantly. That is what we believe in as Catholics. Even though he has papal infallibility, even he has the cardinals. I am truly thankful for the African cardinals who are keeping the rest of the Church in line from becoming Lutheran. Like, that's literally the only thing we have right now is the African cardinals sitting there and saying no to the Germans, who are trying to make their own, pagan religion at this point with it. It's disappointing. It's heartbreaking. But there is a conversation that they're having right now, which is, what future church do we have? Do we have a smaller church that's more ideologically centered? Or do we have a larger church that doesn't believe in many things? Which I think we won't have a larger church anyway if we don't believe in anything.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I got my last.
You know. I hope that was a good answer, but
no,
that
it's great
too. Like, okay,
it's great. And there's everywhere I go, the Latin Mass is getting bigger, whether Francis tries to restrict it or not. I mean, he makes everybody do it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but you go and it's the pews are filled at 3 in the afternoon.
Yeah, and you know, even in Germany, which is like as globalist as it possibly come, which is as nonsensical with a lot of their policies as possible, and they believed we could save Germany by demographically replacing Germans with, you know, everyone in the whole world. The place that still has the largest families, the most intact families, and the most prosperous are the very Catholic parts of the country.
Yeah.
So there is something about preserving overall civilization by saving the church, and I do believe that. So.
Yeah. Great. Well, good. I've got a dog at home too, but I'm in the office now, so I'm going to have to go home and
sorry about that one.
I'm going to have to go home and walk my golden retriever. So, what kind of dog do you have?
I have a Maltipoo who has been absolutely as bad as they come right now.
Wow. Say hello. I love it.
All right. Well, I will thank you for having me on your podcast. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I love it. Thanks. Yeah, we'll do it again. And, you know, I don't know if you're ever around Fox, maybe do one of the shows around here or something. But
I am. I was on Laura last week.
Okay, good. Yeah, you do stuff with Laura. But maybe, you know, because I do the Saturday night show sometimes. Maybe we'll get you on there on the panel.
Yeah, I would love to. Is that Greg's show?
Well, I do Greg's show, but there's a show called Fox News Saturday Night that I host in rotation.
Oh, okay. And, yeah, I'd love to do that. Let me know.
Yeah, and we have panels on there. And are you still in Queens?
Yep.
Still here. You're not going to leave. You're still there.
Blood for punishment. I know.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. All right. So, great.
Good. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you so much. Bye. Bye.